From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, just the biggest question there is, that's all. Why do we suffer? What's the point? And particularly when the young or the innocent suffer. The philosopher Scott Samuelson says, we do two things. We try to fix suffering or we face it. He'll join us to explain how history's great teachers and thinkers have tried to explain pointless suffering. We'll be right back.
Maybe you've heard we're a divided country, but here at KUER, we're going to challenge that idea. I'm Andrea Smartin, the host of Next Door Strangers, a new podcast about finding connection in a time of division. For this to work, we need your help. We'll be asking you to try some things that might take you out of your comfort zone, but maybe that's what we need right now. Next Door Strangers, a new podcast from KUER. Subscribe at KUER.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Scott Samuelson wants to recover what he calls the mystery of suffering. It's a mystery not just because we can't really explain it very well, if at all. But Samuelson says there's this human paradox that's also a mystery, where we try and fix suffering, but also try and face it, accept it. We want it both ways, I think he's saying. And over the centuries, various thinkers and philosophers and poets and artists have tried to find that balance between accepting the fact of senseless suffering, but also opposing it, you know, fighting it. He's written 7 essays exploring 7 ways of looking at this paradox of pointless suffering. Scott Samuelson teaches philosophy at Kirkwood Community College in Iowa. His writing has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the Chicago Tribune. He joined us recently from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City, where he's based. Let's start with Matt, your friend, who was killed tragically when you guys were in 5th grade. You say the question why, this is how you put it in the book, the question of why creeped through your whole body. Just take me there. When you were in 5th grade, how are you working through that? And the fact that it crept into your whole body, I found really kind of powerful.
Yeah, Matt Kaufman was the kind of kid everyone loved. You know, he had this kind of gorgeous blonde hair and piercing eyes, and he was just full of energy and goodwill and mischief. And so he just seemed like the embodiment of life itself, I think, to all of us. And he was out popping wheelies one day on his bike, and a car just sort of came up over a hill way too fast and hit him. And that happened right on the playground, so a lot of the kids actually witnessed it. And we were all pretty traumatized, of course. I went home, and I think I was obsessively playing with my action figures when my mom got the call and told me that he had died, I think, on the way to the hospital. I mean, I felt all sorts of waves of grief, but I felt just this sort of visceral sense of wonder in me. It's often said that philosophy is born of wonder. And, you know, of course, that can sound very nice, you know, you sort of like looking up at the stars and thinking about all the wonderful things. But, of course, wonder can also come out of, I think, pain and tragedy. I think this is just a very basic human experience, maybe one of the most basic human experiences, is just a kind of sense of awe and wonder in the face of death and suffering. And I, you know, I felt it to my core.
You say that the suffering of children can really illustrate that gap between how the world is and how we think it should be. Explain that.
At some level, we start very quickly to try to justify suffering, and I think oftentimes that's not altogether bad, though I think it can be bad at times. And if you think of death, I mean, maybe people don't want to die at all, but most people, I think, can kind of get their head around that, okay, maybe it's okay to die at the end of a full life. And even perhaps, you know, in middle age, at least you've had a chance to do things. But by the time you get to children and we're seeing them suffer and die, it's very difficult to say that is as it should be. It might be hard to do that even throughout the – I think it is hard to do it throughout the ages of our life. But children at some level seem to have some innocence, and even insofar as they've accrued some guilt, they are hard to say that they're deserving of the kinds of suffering that they often have to endure. Mm.
The early part of the book, you kind of track the kind of trajectory of how we used to see suffering and how we come now to see it. And yeah. One of the things you explain is that right now in this current age, we've lost our way mm-hmm. with suffering. Track us through that, because the point is that we're forgetting about the mystery mm-hmm. part. So explain that, if you would.
Yeah. I mean, I think that throughout most of human civilization, we've just had to adopt what I call a face-it attitude when it comes to suffering. That is yeah. to say, we've had to just look squarely at it, and we've come up with all sorts of ways of trying to just accept it and deal with it. Religion, of course, provides us with a set of very powerful tools for doing that. The arts do that. Philosophy has done that. Music, I think, very powerfully does that. And so we have these ways of both expressing our lamentation as well as our hopes by just looking squarely at suffering and accepting that it's a part of the human condition. I wonder, though, if for the past several centuries even, that ability to look things squarely in the eye and accept suffering as part of the human condition has been lost a bit, yeah. And maybe increasingly so. We also have always, as human beings, had another attitude, which I call the fix-it attitude, yep. which is where we see suffering as a problem to be eliminated. Right. We want to get rid of it. And, of course, this is a wonderful part of humanity. Think of all the great technologies and medicines that we've developed that we're all very grateful for, the kind of positive effect they've had at eliminating some suffering. But I think that sometimes we get so into that fix-it quest that we can lose track of the fact that at some level suffering and death and injustices are just baked into the cake of being human. And when we forget that, when we sort of entertain the possibility that we could just get rid of all of this stuff or that these things are simply problems to be solved, I think that we dehumanize ourselves in some ways. And weirdly, I think we end up inflicting more suffering. One way I talk about this in the book a little bit is in terms of, we sometimes use this language of the war on whatever. Yeah. So, you know, we can have the war on drugs or the war on terrorism or the war on crime or the war on poverty or the war on cancer. I mean, we could even imagine a war on death. And I worry about that a little bit, because it makes it sound as if suffering is going to wave the white flag someday and just give up once we finally defeated it once and for all. And I think that these wars, while they might have a good impulse behind them, oftentimes end up taking away some of the mystery that is being human. And also, I think they lead us into sometimes barbarous actions. For instance, the war on crime mm-hmm. can end up locking up a whole lot of innocent people or punishing people way beyond what they deserve, as well as just terrorizing whole communities. So on the one hand, we have to oppose suffering, but I think the war on it, which is what we have a tendency to lapse into, can actually be quite a dangerous thing.
I wonder if you think that we are more literal in the way we think about suffering than we used to, and not just even in a religious way. It seems like that there's a kind of orthodox religious sentiment, and this isn't true of all religions, but that looks at scripture and faith as something quite literal, as opposed to mm-hmm. the mysteries of the past. And it seems mm-hmm. you can apply the same ideas even to people who don't believe in God and see science as a solution, whereas in the past, mm-hmm. there was nothing we could do about certain things. Mm-hmm. But now we can. We can look at disease at the molecular level. We can actually look at age and longevity in absolutely different ways. And so our view is not so mysterious anymore, not so it's more literal now in all kinds of ways. Does that make mm-hmm. sense?
Yes, it does make sense, and I think that's correct. And I think that Yeah, and I think that that's a problem. And I've said that we have both this fix-it drive and this face-it attitude, and I feel like the best human things somehow reconcile those two things, or at least find a way of balancing those two things. And I think that is that fundamental mystery, which is why things like music and art and poetry and religious texts oftentimes are the best things we have for dealing with this, because they contain, you know, the strange metaphors and the powerful back and forth of celebration and suffering, of trying to do what we can to fight for justice, but also accepting the backdrop of pain and suffering against which that fight plays out. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there's a perfect way of reconciling all that into a neat formula.
Yeah.
So I think that it is inevitably mysterious. I don't think it's just that we haven't worked it out yet. I think that there's always some imbalance there. And so I think when we bring a literal mind to trying to deal with it, when we think either we're going to fix it as a problem or else just kind of ignore it as best as we can, and I think we feel that loss.
One of the things you say in the book is that pointless suffering, like I wanted you to give a sort of define our terms mm-hmm. here, what you mean by it and what we mean by evil as compared mm-hmm. to what we mean by pointless suffering, because I liked this. You said, pointless suffering is where the journey of meaning-making begins.
Mm-hmm. Some people have objected to my expression pointless suffering because they, you know, we are such strongly point-seeking animals. We want to believe so strongly that there is a meaning to it all. I don't deny that there might be some kind of meaning, but I just feel like to be human, there is always some element of suffering that doesn't quite add up. Mm-hmm. That we can never fully process, which is why there is this mystery here. It's not just a glitch or a problem to be solved. Traditionally, people have used the word evil, I think, to encompass something like what I mean by pointless suffering. But evil in this very old sense of the word really just means bad stuff happening. It can Yeah. take any number of forms. It can be an earthquake or a tornado. It can be cancer. It could be as well as things like murder and rape. All of those things could be described as evil in this old sense because they're things that we rebel against and think of as being really deeply wrong and inflicting suffering. So, I mean, there's a kind of a big shift that happened in the modern period where evil really got cordoned off to deal with mostly just what humans do.
Yeah.
So it's much easier for us to describe Hitler as evil. It seems a little weird to describe a tornado as evil, but that's why I wanted to use a phrase like, well, first of all, suffering. That's more encompassing, I think, of the issue of both what humans do to each other as well as what happens just as a matter of nature. And then while I think that there's a lot of meaning to be found in suffering, I think we begin our journey by being mystified by it, by saying, why? Why is this happening? Why me? Why us? Why them? Why Matt? And I think that once we go through that journey of meaning making, we can often find that there is a lot of meaning to be found in suffering. But I feel like even at the end of that whole journey, we still stand a little bit in awe of it. It
Yeah.
still doesn't quite all add up. I mean, even if I die and go to heaven and, you know, I say to God, why all this suffering? And he says, well, you see, the Holocaust, it all added up to mean this. I still think I'm going to be a little bit like, I just don't know.
Yeah.
I just don't see how that really, even if all sorts of good stuff came from the Holocaust, I just don't, I'm still, part of me still going to rebel against it. And for that matter, part of me still going to rebel against, you know, the death of Matt Kaufman.
Yeah.
That I just can't fully say, despite all the goods that may have come from it, it's hard for me to say, well, it all adds up. And so I guess it really did have a point. Yes, maybe some of it had a point, but there seems like this pointless element, and that's just – it seems like part of the human condition to have to grapple with that.
Yeah. Well, that's the paradox that you're trying to revive in the book, the idea of accepting yet still opposing it, finding mm-hmm. that balance, I guess.
Right. That's correct, yeah. And I think that some of our best things that we have in life have that balance in it. So like even just think of something like laughter. I mean – you know, what do we laugh about? What do we make jokes about? Oftentimes it is our humiliations, our sufferings, our problems. And laughter both sort of says, yeah, these are problems, but also finds a way of sort of accepting them and being able to laugh at them. Or forgiveness, where we can make a judgment that this was wrong and yet at the same time say, I forgive, or I need forgiveness for this, that we can both accept that there is the suffering as well as say we oppose it. And, you know, in the book, my last chapter deals with the blues, and I feel like, you know, that has that same paradox too, where we lament what's going on, but somehow we also find a way to find almost even jubilance and celebration.
Why only seven? Why only seven ways of looking at pointless suffering? There's got to be a lot more than that. But it turns out you've really worked this through, and it seems like you've really distilled it. It seems like you think that there may be more, but seven get to it in a way, you think.
Well, I think seven gives us at least the basic approaches. I joke in the book that, you know, if I found 13 ways of looking at pointless suffering, the last might be that of the devil himself. And so I thought seven, a lucky number, was a good way of dealing with a very difficult subject. But no, I do. I mean, it's not purely random. In the book, I talk about how we've sort of had three modern ways of really wrestling with it. And then I talk about what I consider to be four just perennial ways that we have of trying to deal with it. Yeah. Within all of those ways I look at, there are, of course, any number of variations. So you're quite right that it's the subject is not exhausted by my book by a long stretch of the imagination.
When one of the things you do also is you don't really just dig into a Buddhist approach or a Christian approach. Mm-hmm. Just mention why. I mean, those are encompassed in some of the others, I have to say, but you don't specifically dig into those particular approaches.
Yeah, I wrestled with that a little bit. I talk about Buddhism and Christianity throughout the book, and in both of those ways very deeply inform how I've thought about it. I mean, in a way, arguably, those are the two greatest traditions for thinking about suffering. Of course, in Christianity, you know, one of its central symbols, maybe its very central symbol, is a symbol of, in a way, of unfair suffering of Jesus on the cross, but that is at the same time the most redemptive suffering imaginable. In the Buddhist tradition, the first noble truth is that life is suffused with suffering, and the other noble truths in some ways are about dealing with that, coming to terms with that, and rising above it. And the Buddhist tradition gives a elaborate tradition with many different voices in it, as does the Christian tradition. Mm. But I feel like those traditions are ones that people are, insofar as they're familiar with this stuff, that they're probably more likely to be familiar with that. And so I wanted to kind of wander down some roads that would put those traditions into play, but also maybe open up some new insights for people.
I want to dig into these three sort of modern ways that we've dealt with suffering, these first sections of the book. Mm-hmm. Let's begin, though, with the story of Ashley. Mm. She's a daughter of some former neighbors of yours, mm-hmm. and I think she's a good way into a conversation about this. You say when you think of Ashley, it made you think of a line from Sophocles, never to have lived is best. As one of the references there, let's mm-hmm. let's talk about Ashley and this story.
Yeah, she was my neighbor for a while. A great family that my family was close to in some ways. When I met Ashley, she was I think an early teenager. The way her sisters put it, that she was born with a broken brain. The doctors didn't give her very long to live when she was born, but in fact, she did live on. But her mental development was pretty much non-existent. Really, was stayed at the level of a baby. Mm-hmm. She couldn't speak. She couldn't really move. She was in a wheelchair. She could thrash around a little bit. She needed to be fed, and she would frequently cry out. She would frequently scream, and she kind of just powerfully embodied this sort of suffering that comes with being alive without really any tools for dealing with it herself. She, of course, had the compassion of her family and those around her who loved her. But it was – I think everyone who met her, you had to wonder, like, is this a life worth having?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that ultimately the answer to that is yes, but it's a very hard yes to have to, to come to. It's very difficult, and I feel as if our strong impulse is we would like to fix Ashley. And I would, of course, like to help her in any way possible. And so far as medicine could be able to do that, that would be wonderful. And of course, insofar as it can ease her pain, that's, you know, good and right. And insofar as we can just have institutions that help her, that's all good. But even after all that, it seems like there's a lot that just can't be fixed there.
Yeah.
And so what do we do with that? Well, that poses that problem. And I think in modernity, we really struggle with that.
Yeah. A lot of the questions that come up in Ashley's life, look, honestly, would Ashley have been better off dead? Was her life in some way some kind of mistake? But you also write this. You say, since her life is part of the life we share, is life itself something of a mistake? Which is that big existential question. I mean, what is the point of all of this?
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's important, though, for us to remember, and maybe this is one of the great things that Ashley did for me, was, you know, she does remind me of that I do share that life with her, and
yeah,
that and that even though she's on the kind of borderline of being human, in that she has, you know, no real possibilities of cognitive development, that she still is, as her sister put it, you know, someone with a broken brain. She's a human being, but broken in some ways. And that brokenness, I suppose, we all have in some way, shape, or form. And so her life is a part of my life, and a part of our life. The problems that she poses are the problems that we have, period, as human beings.
Yeah. Edvard Munch's The Scream, that painting, that iconic mm-hmm. painting you write about in the book. And it's the idea is it's supposed to convey the very essence of pointless suffering. But mm-hmm. you say you have mixed feelings about that painting.
Well, it lends itself to parodies, for one.
Yeah.
you know, I mean, insofar as I think it is so powerful for us, it does embody this issue. It sort of says, look, here's someone crying out. Here's someone screaming in pain. And there is no story around it. You know, if you think of classical images of suffering, the crucifixion being probably the most well-known one for people, you know, that's a terrible act of suffering. And sometimes Jesus is portrayed in great agony and crying out. But of course, the surrounding story of that kind of allows us to, you know, deal with that suffering because we know that it's redemptive. Or there's another great image that I actually have on the cover of my book, or at least the face of Laocoon, who was the Trojan priest who tried to keep the Trojan horse from coming in, and the gods wanted the Greeks to win, and so they send sea serpents to kill him. So for being a good, decent human being trying to protect his city, he's violently massacred along with his children. So it seems like just a clear-cut case of unfair, terrible, pointless suffering. But of course, the Romans who made that very image understood that because Laocoon's cry was not heard by others, that Troy fell. But because Troy fell, Aeneas came and founded Rome eventually. And so, even
there was
that
a point.
Kind of terrible, there was a point to
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And that point allows us to look at those images, I think, in ways that make them easier. Whereas the scream, I think, is just meant to be the scream. There is no redemptive story surrounding it. There's no point there. It's just the crying out that I think we increasingly face in modern life.
Talk about what you make of the so-called problem of evil, which is often used as an argument against a god, that this idea of a god is not compatible with this idea of pointless suffering. I mean, what is the point of God if good people suffer? And this concept that you said that really took you back in something that you read that said believing in a god is, in fact, in this sense, profoundly immoral.
Yeah, well, the problem of evil, I think, really embodies the difficulties we have in the modern age. As we become so driven by our fix-it quest, as we become so driven by our attempt to fix all suffering, to oppose it all, get rid of it, then God starts to seem very hard for most people to believe in, if insofar as you're committed to that fix-it quest, because you just think, look, if God made all this, he really screwed up quite badly, because
right.
we're trying to, you know, fix all the stuff, all the problems that he didn't fix. It's to make God into a kind of, you know, big defective biotechnologist, or even worse, I suppose, a God who stands by, who could help people and refuses to. which seems like the essence of cruelty to us, to imagine standing by, you know, and letting someone suffer and die when you had the power to do otherwise seems deeply wrong. So in that sense, if we go down that road, then the belief in God just seems horrendous. And a lot of people feel like what's called the problem of evil is a clear-cut refutation of at least of a good, powerful God. There's some truth in that, at least in the sense, I think, that there, of course, is a lot of suffering that just doesn't add up. In fact, even in our great religious traditions, even in like a book like the Bible, it's quite clear, like, look, read the book of Job, you know, that yes, indeed, the suffering doesn't add up. And the people who go around saying, like Job's friends, that, oh, it all makes sense and you deserve your suffering, Job, are in some sense wrong, deeply wrong. At the same time, though, I feel like the problem of evil misses out on something very important, which is that sense that we wouldn't even be human without the problem of evil. And so in this sense, the problem of evil I don't see as refuting God. I see it as posing a deep challenge and posing a deep mystery. And that deep mystery we've dealt with by thinking of God. God's the site of the mystery, not so much a problem to be solved or done away with, just as to be human is also to confront a mystery. That we can't – it's not about solving it or getting rid of it. This isn't just about biotechnology. It's about these deeper mysteries, and I think religion takes us to those. I mean, it's kind of funny that suffering can drive people away from God, but of course, for many people, suffering is what brings them to religion.
Yeah. Ashley's mother is religious. She's a Mormon.
Correct.
So her perspective is her filter. That is how she sees the purpose of Ashley's presence and the life that she is or isn't living, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's a powerful way of seeing her in those religious terms, because to see Ashley as a soul, even if, you know, a very broken soul, but nonetheless as a soul, as someone with kind of an infinitely precious value, but someone who, again, poses a very deep mystery for us, that our job is to help and do what we can, but at some level to get down on our knees and you know, bow before that greater mystery.
I have to say, a really powerful story you tell about this moment when you were helping out with Ashley, and you guys struggled to get her back settled at home, and it was kind of traumatic for the moment, and she was cold, and it was rough, and but it was such a powerful moment, I say, and because you write about this moment is you understood just how, this is how you put it in the book, how fragile your higher identity was. I mean, when you just stared at her. Mm-hmm. And you saw something in there that she wasn't just a screen, as you put it, that reference to Munch. Say something about that.
Yeah, well, I had to get her into the house. I was supposed to take just help out with her because her mom was away running an errand, I believe. And you know, I just was having trouble getting in. Her wheelchair was not going in well, and it was cold out. And you know, so I had to really struggle to kind of lift her up, and she was crying out, and you know, tears were running down her face, and I was trying to get her adjusted. But I think in some ways in that act of caretaking and her basic needs crying out, I started to really look at her, and I didn't just see her as, you know, someone who screamed a lot or as a problem. I saw her as connected to me. And I realized my own, you know, the very fragile state I'm in. I mean, you know, it doesn't, you know, a bite from a rabid dog or a, you know, a infectious mosquito bite could potentially cancel out my higher consciousness, and I wouldn't be so far from Ashley there.
Yeah.
And that helped me in some ways to see her as having that infinite value that I think her mom sees her as having too.
Scott Samuelson, his book is 7 Ways of Looking at Pointless Suffering: What Philosophy Can Tell Us About the Hardest Mystery of All. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
If you're about to part ways with your old car, consider donating it to KUER. We'll take your vehicle in almost any condition, and we'll even arrange to pick it up. proceeds from your donation support the KUER programs you love, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Radio West. Learn more about our vehicle donation program at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with philosophy professor Scott Samuelson. We're talking about his book, Seven Ways of Looking at Pointless Suffering. Let's start with number one. We should eliminate pointless suffering. You tell the story of John Stuart Mill. And maybe we should begin with the sort of circumstance he finds himself in at the beginning of this chapter. This is in 1826. John Stuart Mill is a very sort of emotionally fragile 20-year-old man and in a really deep depression.
Yeah, he was raised with a very strict utilitarian education. Utilitarianism is the moral philosophy associated first and foremost probably with Jeremy Bentham.
Yeah.
So Mill was raised according to this view that really suffering's flat out bad and the moral life just means eliminating suffering. Insofar as we can bring about the greatest kind of satisfaction for people, we've done the best we can do. So suffering's a problem and the goal is to solve it. And it's, again, there's a very powerful modern view. Maybe it distills the modern view to its nut, you know, into its quintessence. Well, Mill was raised that way. And you might think, well, if someone's trying to bring about the greatest happiness for everyone, then that would be the best thing possible. But ironically, that education led Mill to a nervous breakdown. And he tried to kind of revise utilitarianism, I think, in light of what he discovered in that breakdown. And that's why Mill, to me, is a much more interesting version of utilitarian philosophy than a lot of it, that Mill recognized the importance of things like poetry and freedom. Because I think he recognized that they spoke to certain fundamental human goods, that when we lose those things, we lose out altogether. But the difficulty he has is reconciling those with utilitarianism.
Yeah.
Because so I leave him as just a kind of the puzzle that we start off with, which is we try to fix suffering and it kind of blows up in our face at some level and we have to figure out, well, what are the limits of that?
Well, the thing that transforms him, and I think this is really interesting, is not the again, the more utilitarian stuff, but the more abstract stuff, poetry, and finally love. I mean, love absolutely transforms John Stuart Mill's life.
Yeah, that's right. He falls in love with Harriet Taylor, and she's a married woman at the time too. They have a very close friendship and partnership that goes on throughout their lives. Eventually, Harriet Taylor's husband dies, and Mill says, kind of ironically, like, out of that evil came my own greatest good, and he ended up marrying her. But yeah, that love, I think, awoken him to something else. And I think he saw, you know, again, something of that paradox I'm talking about. He saw in Harriet Taylor someone who embodied that same quest for social justice and for making the world a better place that he got from his father. Mm-hmm. And that is the best legacy, I think, of utilitarianism. But he also saw something that went beyond that. He saw a more emotional side of things, a side of things that reminded us of why it was worth fighting for to begin with, why fighting for a better world was worth it. I think love does that.
Yeah. Yeah. Number two, we should embrace pointless suffering. This brings us to Nietzsche and his view. It's interesting. You tell a little bit of the story of Nietzsche. He loses his father to this brain disease, terrible, and it influences the way he comes to think about suffering. Of course, people know, I think most of us know, he gives up on Christianity, gives up on this idea of God because of science. You know, he has and this new historical research into religion Talk a little bit about this. What I'm really interested in is resentiment as a concept that informs Nietzsche's view. Do you want to say something about that?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, just, you know, the phrase I think we often associate Nietzsche with is God is dead. And,
yeah.
And that's that view that you're talking about, that somehow our ability to believe and have faith in God, he thinks, has seriously been eroded in the modern age. And so he tries to kind of just rethink everything from the ground up. And, well, he talks about two kinds of moralities, what he calls a master morality, which in some ways embraces suffering. It says, look, I understand that to become greater, I need to make great risks. I need to suffer, and at times I need to inflict suffering.
Yeah.
But I need to try to do that in a healthy manner. And he thinks that that there were really old traditions of doing this, kind of like warrior traditions that go way back. But then he sees this new morality developing that he calls a slave morality, where people feel thwarted and they feel like they can't compete at that level. And so they're filled with resentment, resentiment in French, and he uses, which is kind of like, it's not just that you wish you had something else, but you want to take almost revenge on people because of that resentment you feel. And he feels like the kind of great act of slave morality was coming up with a way of seeing things that took an imaginary revenge on those masters practicing their acts of power. So because the slaves couldn't, you know, literally fight back, they kind of imaginatively fought back and imagined that all those acts of power were actually evil and that they would be punished in the afterlife for those things. And he sees that as a kind of he thinks it's a very interesting and powerful thing that they did, but he thinks that it's ultimately unhealthy and we're suffering from that now.
So Nietzsche, basically his view in terms of dealing with pointless suffering is that we embrace the whole of our lives, I think is mm-hmm. how you put it, is
correct,
to
yeah.
live all of those aspects of them, live artistically, I guess, live dangerously is mm-hmm. how he puts it as well. But say something
that's
about
right.
this, because this is his twist on it, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I kind of think of my first two chapters as like vacillating between two real extremes. On the one extreme, we can say we need to fix suffering. That's the pure utilitarian view. On the other extreme, you just need to completely dive into it and
yep.
embrace it and say this is what it's supposed to be. And Nietzsche represents that extreme. He has a famous thought experiment of saying, you know, you should be spiritually healthy enough that you should say, I will everything in my life to happen again and again, endlessly, on endless repeat. You know, all the things that I involved my suffering or my mistakes or my humiliations, you say yes to all of them. And that in saying yes to that, you're empowered and potentially have the potential for the fullest kind of life imaginable. And so I think he's constantly trying to come up with a new way of thinking about suffering that gets us away from some of our older forms. And I think there's a lot of good in Nietzsche's reminder that suffering is a part of life and that we can't just fix it and that at times we do need to dive into it. Mm-hmm. I also worry that he goes too far in that direction too.
Yeah.
I don't know that we can will things to be on endless repeat. I feel like there's this part of us that always will rebel against some suffering. You know, Nietzsche went mad at the end of his life and lived almost the last 10 years in a catatonic state, maybe not so unlike Ashley. I find it hard to will that over and over and over for him,
yeah.
Let alone for me.
Well, there's a video of it.
There is,
maybe
yeah.
people – I had no idea. This is from, what was it, 1899
yeah.
or something like that of Nietzsche just – there in that catatonic state. It's kind of a remarkable video, and you talk about watching it and
yeah.
the impact that it had on you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can't remember, you know, what YouTube rabbit hole I'd gone down, but I came across that video of Nietzsche, and I just became mesmerized by it, watching it over and over, because, you know, it's just looking at this thinker I'd studied and who was, you know, was so alive and whose mind was full of such, you know, powerful, fascinating thoughts. And then here he is, and you just think, is he still there?
Yeah.
Who is he?
Yeah.
I suppose I had another moment that not unlike my moment dealing with Ashley.
Yeah. Let's talk about number three, Hannah Arendt. The essence of what Arendt gets at is that we need to begin to act into nature. talk a little bit about her, where she's coming from. Give us a sense of that.
Well, very briefly, I mean, the phrase that's probably most commonly associated with Arendt is the phrase, the banality of evil.
Yeah.
And I feel like this kind of gets at a really interesting issue in the modern world that we all need to come to terms with. And she coins that phrase, to make a long story short, she's a German Jew who ended up fleeing to America as World War II was just starting. She, of course, knows all sorts of people who were killed in the Holocaust. She has to wrestle with the big question of why. In this case, it's, you know, unlike the theological question of old where we say, why did God allow this terrible tornado to kill so many people? Now we're asking the question in a way to ourselves. We're looking in the mirror as human beings and saying, why did we do this to each other? The Holocaust in some ways is worse than any natural disaster.
Yeah. Yeah.
So why did this happen? Well, I mean, I suppose one answer is human beings are just really evil and you know, we're demonic creatures. And I suppose at times we can be. But Arendt had grown up in Germany. She knew Germans, and she knew that that wasn't the whole story, that it wasn't just that Germans were full of evil monsters who, you know, let loose. Yes, there's evil impulses in all of us, but what made this so bad? Well, she realized on the one hand that we had this tremendous technological power now that we didn't before. And she also realized that people could get just kind of plugged into a system where they felt as if they were just doing their job. It's like sometimes I go and complain, you know, at a store and the person I'm complaining to says, hey, man, I just work here.
Yeah.
You know, and there's this sense of like, I need the job. I'm just told to do one little task here. I'm not supposed to do anything else. Moreover, I don't even want to think about what this company's doing. I don't necessarily agree with it or whatever. I just need the job. I'm just doing my job. And she realized that that kind of just what she called banal approach to things could lead to great evils. In the case of the Nazis, people could more or less just say, hey, I was just doing my job. I don't have anything against Jews or gypsies or I'm just showed up to work. What else was I supposed to do? And she worried about that because I think as human beings, we find ourselves in this position where we're all participating in these big systems. And in one level, we just have our minor day-to-day concerns on our minds. But these big systems all of a sudden now have tremendous power. Think about things like global warming or nuclear holocaust or just the Holocaust itself show the power that humans have to act into nature, to radically alter human lives and the life of the whole planet. Mm. And so she's like, okay, well, we got to start thinking a little bit about what it means to take responsibility for this power that we've found ourselves having.
Number four, pointless suffering reveals God.
Mm-hmm.
And you take on the story of Job, the book of Job in the Bible, a folk tale about injustice. Let's talk a little bit about this. What's interesting about it is you say you find the ending of Job, and I'm sure maybe people don't know the story. I'm guessing that they do. We've actually talked about it on the show a few times. But Job gets everything restored finally in the end once the devil and God sort of have their way with Job in this test. Things are restored to him, and that bothers you, you say.
Yeah, it does. I mean, because I feel as if you can't just make up for it.
Yeah.
You know, in the story, he's given like three daughters who are more beautiful than his previous daughters. Well, you know, I don't know that. I'm sure that if you've lost children, having new children can be a great balm for you and joy. But I don't know that they ever make up for the old ones or think, well, these are better looking and smarter. So I guess we're good. And I feel like that makes the larger point that we go through suffering, and I don't know that it's ever going to be completely remedied, even if everything is restored and made perfect and wonderful. I kind of prefer the agonizing discussions in the Book of Job more to the end, though. I understand the end potentially could be read more in a symbolic way of you know, this represents the hope that we all have to believe in, that there is, you know, a better state coming. You know, you think of the great speech of Martin Luther King, I have a dream. I mean, perhaps we have to have that dream of that the Book of Job symbolically represents the end. I contrast it to, you know, the story of Jesus being resurrected, and of course he still has his wounds. And you know, Thomas has to finger the wound in his side in order to believe in him. And I like that as a story, maybe, or an ending a little bit better, that even in this new state that we can maybe achieve, that's a better world, we're still going to have those wounds from the past.
Yeah. One more thing about Job. What interesting, you mentioned one of the most significant details about it is where his friends, who I have to say are kind of jerks throughout, or can be, but there is this moment when they just sit there with him, literally just sit there with him for 7 days and say nothing. You find that to be a kind of profound moment.
I do. That's the best thing about Job's friends is when they just are quiet and they just sit with him. And I think that that's a great lesson. I mean, it's a lesson I think we all learn in our own way. But the lesson is that it showing up matters, particularly when people are suffering. It's not so much about having a story that makes sense of it, or telling them they're in a better place now, or saying they deserved it, or anything like that. It's just showing up to people when they need you, when they're grieving or when they're suffering, and that goes a very long way.
This gets us to number 7. In this chapter, we get to see your connection to the blues and the question of whether does profound art that comes out of suffering, does that redeem suffering? Talk about Sidney Bechet and the blues, because this is where you end up. And this seems like for you the one that resonates most.
It does in some ways. You know, I've always loved music, and when I first encountered the blues and jazz, people like Louis Armstrong and Billie Holiday and John Coltrane, I just had this feeling that they were doing something that seemed fuller, truer, realer to me. And so I've been thinking about music for a long time, and I grew to love Sidney Bechet's music too. He is a very early kind of master of the clarinet and the soprano saxophone. Associated with the kind of New Orleans Dixieland music, but it's a very profound version of it, and one deeply rooted in the blues. And he has a great autobiography called Treat It Gentle, where he talks about his music as a way of trying to grapple with the suffering that he had faced, but also the legacy of suffering in his family. He talks about his grandfather, who was a slave, and his grandmother, who was a slave, and the kinds of horrible things they endured. And he talks about his music as like water trying to wash over that stone of suffering again and again and again. I feel as if the beauty of the blues to me at its best is that it balances out these contradictory things in us. It laments injustice, and I think it still has space in it to protest and fight against injustice, and yet it also recognizes that, you know, we're human beings, and our humanity is bound up with the inflicting of injustice, and as well as with the suffering of it. And so the blues, to me, at its best, it balances out those different sides of things that create that mystery, and it poses the mystery anew for us, because when we listen to the blues, we confront oftentimes deep sadness. But it's also one of the most joyful forms of music, one of the forms of music that can make us feel human again in the face of the things we have to endure.
Let me ask you finally, you mentioned earlier in the conversation you're not crazy about the idea of making all these connections in to terms of war. We shouldn't think of our relationship to suffering in terms of war, you say. But you do come around in the book to saying that the paradox of facing and also fighting suffering can pretty well be expressed as engaging in martial arts.
Right. Yeah. I mean, because I like the image of the martial artist, because the martial artist bows before and after the battle. So that they're willing to fight, and they see the fight as an important thing and a good thing and sometimes a necessary thing. So they don't give up, but at the same time, they show respect for what they're battling against. They never forget that. And I think the bowing before and after the bout is a good thing. And I think that's a kind of metaphor perhaps for how we can, you know, I think it's good to fight cancer, for instance. Yeah. But I think that at some level we have to bow a little bit to the power of nature and to death itself. And if we forget to bow to those things, I think we're in trouble.
Scott Samuelson. His book is Seven Ways of Looking at Pointless Suffering, What Philosophy Can Tell Us About the Hardest Mystery of All. He joined us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program was directed by Tim Slover, produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.